Oh, hello there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, Winter. How things going?
So great.
Good. We got journalist, novelist, and creator of Human Beings, Margaret Wobbler.
Hey there, Guy. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. It's a lovely day in Los Angeles. We have nothing
sure
to complain
is.
About.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Except for Cambridge Analytica stealing our brains.
Jesus Christ.
That's fair. That's fair. And we've got pop culture scholar and dyke about town, Karen Toxin.
Hey, Guy. Hi, Rocketeers.
Hey, Karen. Karen, I can't tell if you want me or don't want me to say dyke about town.
You're always allowed to say dyke about town because I am always about town.
You're literally a dyke and you're about town.
And I think am about town.
You guys should have that push-pull. You know, that makes a good dramatic
that tension,
relationship.
It's so moonlighting. It's
yeah.
great.
A couple of years ago, I rewatched like the first season of Moonlighting and the first season of Heart to Heart. Moonlighting holds up so well.
So well.
Sure
Heart
it does.
To Heart, that staircase that
yes.
she descends
oh
in her apartment.
Oh. She's so beautiful.
That's Mrs. H.
And he's so happy
gorgeous.
To be there. He's the most happiest to be there
we're,
person
we're
ever.
We're scrapping our topics. We're just talking about Cybill Shepherd for the next hour.
Okay.
And her silkwear.
All right, coming. We're not doing that. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to talk about our problematic faves. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Winter Mitchell, what are you all about this week?
Well, this is super duper topical because it just came out this morning. Cynthia Nixon, a.k.a. Miranda Hobbs, she's running for New York governor.
This is a time to stick our necks out, to remember where we came from. This is a time to be visible. This is a time to fight.
I'm Cynthia Nixon. I'm a New Yorker.
Woo!
How do we feel about this?
So great.
I mean, you want your governor to be a Miranda, right?
Yes! Jesus Christ! Thank you for hitting that. I am so proud of her. Irrationally proud. Because the one thing that I've learned in the midst of this craziness between Sarah Jessica Parker, whom I actually really love, and Kim Cattrall. Like, it's like your aunt's fighting. Your mom and your
yeah,
fighting with her sister,
sad.
Those two. That there was
so heartbreaking.
So heartbreaking. Yeah. It is actually heartbreaking that I don't even need that movie. That I wasn't asking for it.
No.
But I actually now really don't need it to impede whatever plan. We want this movie.
Yeah, Cynthia's obviously moved on.
Do you think she waited until she found out whether the movie was going to happen or not?
Hell yeah. She was like, look, she's no dummy. She's Miranda Hobbs. She's like, if I can get another little check out of this, fine. She watched them go at it, and she probably had like a confirmation call with one of them, or she did that Mean Girls thing where she had one on the line, and then it split screen, and then it was like Sarah Jessica, and she decided like, okay, this is never happening. I can completely run for governor. But you know what I'm going to start calling her? And everybody's going to get real mad about it. New Hillary.
Really?
Sorry.
Why?
I have to say that there's something in the campaign video that gives those vibes.
Yeah.
Right?
She's like a Hillary that
her
you
announcement
can hang
video.
Out, you can have a beer with.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's what she is.
Oh, that's interesting.
But that automatically is like not Hillary to me.
No. But like the thing is like, here's what, I guess when I think of Hillary, for me, the archetype of Hillary is like an incredibly smart, accomplished, independent, you know, playing this game with you, Bill, because I have to, because that's what those people like. But generally, I could give a fuck less. Mm. I want to do me. And Hillary's been doing a lot of apologizing lately, which I just can't quite
she doesn't have to.
Yeah.
She needs better strategists. But Cynthia Nixon, young, lesbian, mom, hit show. We've seen her boobs. Everybody knows about it. It doesn't matter because her policies are completely dope. And she's really just talking about, like, I'm tired of New York being a piece of shit. Let's fix it. And that's the straight talk, smart, whistle stop, you know, chilly, beer drinking, but also smart and can rip apart, like, the Cattrall Parker Accord, as Ira Madison called it. You know, I like that.
How do you guys feel about this?
I feel very excited about it, first of all, because I felt very excited about the fact that Cynthia Nixon ended up with like a totally butch lesbian
yeah.
as her partner.
Very butch.
After having been married and then like, you know, had these kids and all the whole thing. And the campaign video, which I watched today, like it gave me little goosebumps.
Yeah.
Also because, you know, in many respects, it is like a traditional campaign video, which is like, I'm a New Yorker. I'm born and raised here, blah, blah, blah. But then you see her, all those scenes at home that they show you with a candidate with their kids and mm-hmm. fixing their hair mm-hmm. and having coffee. It's with this like totally like butch dyke hanging out in the background who's her partner, which is a remarkable thing to me, yes. which is like, you know, where it there's no commentary. There's no
explaining aspect. It.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's just, this is the fact, this is my facts yeah. of life.
Yeah.
And these are my facts of life. And you know, this is me looking amazing on a train and with also being shot from below and looking amazing, yeah. which I was like, who accomplished that? That cinematographer should be thanked.
Somebody she's always Sex in the City.
She's yeah. always been skinny of the chin and the neck.
Yeah. She's just had the great, like, so from a completely non-New Yorker perspective, not being aware of her policies at all, I'm all for it. And I'm very excited about like this young, impassioned, relatively young, impassioned, very politically engaged person running for political office in a way that I think will be captivating to people.
Yeah.
I think actors have always gotten guff for anything they do outside of acting, but we now in this era of Trump are just going to have to accept that politicians are going to come in all ways, oh, shapes yeah. and forms. And I feel like, fine, throw the doors open. Like if we at this point, I'm like, just bring them all in and I will vote for the people that exactly. represent my values.
The way
like,
it was intended.
End of story. You know what I mean? Like I don't care anymore if you're an actor or you're a businessman or you're whoever. Like as long as you have the ideas that I want to see in this world and this culture, I'll vote for you.
You can work at a Yoshinoya.
Ooh, I'm intrigued.
There was a narrative around Supreme Court justice appointees a couple of times ago when it was basically like they came up with a list of women and then two of the women basically had to say like, we're lesbians, you're not going to nominate us. Mm. And I get sort of like sad for those people who played the traditional political game, who like thought they couldn't play the traditional political game because they were queer or whatever, or people who tried to do it in the most like circumspective ways or whatever. And so it does make me like a little bit sad for those responsible like lesbian lawyers who went to Yale and are like just now trying to like get into the state assembly because they've crossed all of their T's and dotted all of their I's. And part of me is like, fuck it. Like,
Why hold anyone's hand anymore?
Yeah. Cynthia Nixon also went to Yale. Yeah. And also, she went to the drama school. Yes.
And also, by the way, I'm just jealous that New York might have a governor that won a Tony.
And played Emily Dickinson in a movie.
And played Emily Dickinson and Pat Nixon.
Well, America's first Jewish Miss America, Bess Meyerson, ran for Senate and like came pretty close to winning.
Oh, that's like, is that the same?
It's not the same, but it is New York having like a show busy like state politics game.
Sure, sure, sure.
Yes. Margaret Wappler, what's your jam? No, Margaret Wappler, what are you all about?
I
have growing jam all about dyslexia or like color blindness?
You just can't tell the difference yes. anymore. This is a song, guy. It's The Bright Hour by Nina Riggs. So a lot of people are going to know this book purely by the Washington Post article that ran a few weeks ago, which was about Nina Riggs's widowed husband, John Duberstein, marrying Lucy Kalanithi, who also had a memoirist husband that died of cancer. So basically, these two people wrote memoirs, died, and their spouses managed to find each other in this big, wide, crazy world.
Whoa.
Yeah, which is a really beautiful and touching story. Both were published in 2017 to Acclaim. Paul Kalanithi's memoir is called When Breath Becomes Air. Nina Riggs is called The Bright Hour. The Bright Hour is the one that I read. I just assigned it to my memoir class, and it's just a really lovely book. It's hard to, I mean, obviously, the idea of writing a optimistic cancer memoir sounds like ridiculous and impossible, but this woman manages to do it where she has years to live, months to live, and she doesn't do anything that's like hokey bucket lists, like I'm going to go skydiving and I'm going to go, you know, I don't know, eat a live scorpion in Nepal or something. She just basically just keeps on living her life with these two kids and her husband and living in North Carolina. But she does it with just such grace and awareness. And she's a relative of Ralph Waldo Emerson. So she quotes him quite liberally and brings in his ideas about, you know, just what it means to sort of transcend this plane. Sometimes those quotes get too much for me, as well as like some Montaigne quotes that she's
Emersonian
of,
quotes.
At least she wasn't Erica, but she's related to, like, I don't know, the guy who created McDonald's.
Ray Kroc?
Ray
Kroc. Who went to my high school, actually.
Oh, that's great.
But yeah, it gets to be a little too much sometimes, but I'm also like, you know, cool, it's your great-grandfather or whatever, so I'm going to allow it. But it's a very luminous, funny, open-hearted book. And I do think there's something to be said about a book that just takes on the idea of like what it means to be living a meaningful life when you have limited time. Like, how do you do that? Like, we all ask that question all the time. Like, okay, if you only had 2 more months to live, like, what would you do? What would you do? And in a way, like, the fact that this woman just keeps on living her life is the biggest statement of happiness I've ever heard of. Like, she doesn't try to change anything radically.
Well, also continuing to work on a book in that period of time and not just being like, I'm going to be me, you know?
Right. Or just like, I'm going to get drunk all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a difficult thing, as this whole room knows, to be like working on a book or writing something, because it's like the tortuous, do I go to a physical therapy appointment or do I write my book? Do I, you know, like pay this bill or work on my book or that kind
do
of
thing? Do I go to
Do I go to the Korean spa or work on my book?
But the added, like, you know, mortality, obviously you're going to have a lot of different reflections about confronting that and finding, carving out the space to be able to do that without feeling like you're stealing time from the other experiences of life just seems so difficult and also really profound.
Yeah, absolutely. Part of the reason this book was published is because she wrote a modern love column called When a Couch is More Than a Couch, which is part of the book as well. And it basically is all about her searching for the perfect couch, knowing she's going to die and not really get to enjoy it. And there's something really lovely and just like minor drama about it of like, okay, you're like, I can't imagine shopping for something when you know that's going to happen to you.
Yeah.
Like, what are the specifications? I mean, she talks about how she wants it to be like the most beautiful couch, the most comfortable couch, the most like hip couch. Like, and it's, all those terms get rendered kind of absurd in the light of what she's going through. But at the same time, you would think, yeah, when you are dying, you do just still have to do your shopping and your Amazon orders and whatever else.
This is stuff of life.
It is, yeah.
So, Karen, how are you going to follow that up? we've gone from like staring into the abyss and the abyss staring back. What do you got?
Well, a show that's about staring into the abyss and figuring it out in its own way, which is The Good Fight, which we've talked about on the show a little bit before. But The Good Fight is obviously the spinoff of The Good Wife, and it's on CBS All Access for all 12 of you out there who subscribe. And
hey, a lot of people love Star Trek. Old survivors.
Yeah, it's really tempting, that, like, you know, trial period, right? But I just really fell into it because I watched the first few episodes when we talked about like our legal drama show ages ago. But I just like jumped back in, and it is super compelling, and I can't stop watching it right now. And I'm like already run out of current episodes because we're now 3 episodes into season 2. And one of the things I really like about it is that at first you think this is all going to be, you know, a Christine Baranski vehicle entirely. And it's all going to be about Diane Lockhart. It's all going to be about, like, fleshing out the characters who existed in the past on The Good Wife. But actually, you know, The Good Fight has its own life. And, you know, there are heavy-duty veterans on this show. I mean, you've got Bernadette Peters.
Whoa.
On this show. She plays the wife of a kind of Madoff-esque guy, like, who's at the start of the drama, who inaugurates the drama. Like, he's convicted for a Ponzi scheme. His last name is Rendell. I can't remember what everyone's first names are. And Bernadette is the wife. And you find out that she's got all sorts of shady things going on. You know, but she's one of the, again, senior characters on the show. You've got Delroy Lindo. as the kind of head of this firm that was formerly adversarial to Diane Lockhart's character. But the true points of interest are really the associates of the law firm. Kush Jumbo, who returns as Luca Quinn, and Rose Leslie is Maya Rendell, who's the daughter of the Ponzi schemer,
ooh,
who also happens to be a lesbian. La lesbian dangereuse. And, you know, so she's a young associate on
Rose
this.
Rose Leslie, who also played the character on,
like,
Games of Thrones.
On Game of Thrones.
Game
yeah,
of Thrones.
Like the.
She's,
wait, who is she on Game of Thrones?
You know nothing, Jon Snow.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think, aren't they like engaged in real life or something? Or am I like making that up?
She's, I think so.
She's oh, the, yeah, to Jon Snow.
Yeah.
She's the redhead who wanted to type on Downton Abbey.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and, yeah. Well, she's a main character on The Good Fight. She plays a lesbian who's like the daughter of this Ponzi schemer who's also been ensnared in like all of the legalistic drama there. But yet she's also a young lawyer. And so there's a lot of drama that centers around like her culpability in relationship to this, etc. Yeah, the supporting character is amazing. Sarah Steele is Marissa, who's like this quirky character who's Diane's assistant and also an aspiring investigator. Carrie Preston was in it for a while in season one, being a brilliant Carrie Preston, as she always is, at Elsbeth Toscioni, who is a perfect foil for the grotesque returning from The Good Wife character Matthew Perry as Mike Kristeva, the failed politician, DOJ attorney.
Wait, he's on a CBS All Access show?
Well, he had a recurring role, but he's like phased out of season one. I'm just like, but again, it is very...
What is this you're talking about?
He's very
he said
grotesque.
That's so snooty. You're like, he's on CBS All Access.
Season two has hit it off really large because Audra frickin' McDonald has now joined the cast as Liz Reddick, Lawrence, who's a former U.S. attorney and the ex-wife of the named partner, Adrian Bozeman, who's like the firm that Diane Lockhart works for now. And, you know, to see Christine Baranski and Audra McDonald playing a scene together, sipping cocktails in some trashy D.C. hotel bar, or not trashy, an opulent one, rather. It's just, that's just pure CBS Access Gold. Like, I mean, you know, it's worth the $5.99.
And that pan, there's always that slow horizontal pan.
Just to see them chewing the scenery, chatting and chewing and like being tough ladies.
They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Lovely. Oh. Karen, I'm very excited to tell you about my All About.
Mm.
But first, I have to give prologue of how I discovered my All About, because it comes straight from, or indirectly from, the Pop Rocket Facebook page. There was some sort of conversation about food and movies, and I said something about Babette's Feast.
Yes.
And then I think you made the point that Deep Tran,
yeah,
had been talking about it on Catherine Swire's podcast, Smart Mouth. And so I went and listened to it. I was immediately in just a, why am I not friends with Deep Tran? Like, she's everything I'm looking for in a person. There was an extended conversation.
Babette's Feast.
That, but also her talking about how Hungry Man dinners were a performance of masculinity that she, like, hungered for as a child. Wonderful. Then she talks about a TV show. And I was like, what a wonderful TV show. It was a magical TV show. And I was like, where is it? Where can I stream it? And the answer is, it's all on fucking Hulu, just waiting for you. The show is called The Supersizers Go. It is a terrible title. Have you seen this?
I have not seen it.
Okay, so it is based on, like, the concept comes from Supersize Me, the Morgan Spurlock documentary about how eating McDonald's is bad. It's nothing like that. What it is a British food critic, Giles Corran, and a British comedian, Sue from British Baking Show, and they for 1 week eat the food of some era in British history.
Last but not least, mock apricot tart, made from grated carrots, almond essence and plum jam, and served with mock cream, that is, margarine, sugar and flour.
All this mock food is beginning to make me feel like a mock chef.
It wasn't mock belt, sorry about
dear,
that.
Oh dear,
wasn't a belt, I made that from air.
That's mock change the atmosphere. Oh dear.
Oh wow, what a great concept.
So good. like they start off with the 40s during rationing. You get Regency, you get Restoration, you go all the way back to ancient Rome, you go all the way up to the 1980s. It's so good. Like, it is just delightful, and there are so many things about it that are wonderful. Giles is just like exactly the kind of gentle hot douchebag that was allowed in 2008 and we now understand is a problematic fave. But he's like being such a like cute squirmy like asshole that you're just like, I love you and shut the fuck up. And then two is like the low-key best thing about this show is because they do things. They put on clothes. They like sometimes do dancing or activities or prepare for like for to be home guard in the war effort or whatever. And just having this like soft butch lesbian have to fit herself into femininity in each of these eras and being game, never being like, oh, I hate this, always being game and going for it, but also going for the laugh. Like, she, there's something so nice. It's so rare is the situation that you have one person whose responsibility is to make things funny, and that person is the woman. And it's just so fun. It's just so satisfying. And like, all 12 episodes are on your fucking Hulu right now, and you had no idea.
That's really incredible. I mean, you know, so they eat period foods,
yes.
Period specific food. Like, what are 80s foods?
And they do a nice job of sort of like bouncing around within the era. So like in the 80s, they start off and like she's a publicist and he's an investment banker, and they eat sort of like the nouvelle cuisine that was all in the restaurants in the 1980s. And it's tiny
fusion.
Little things. What?
Fusion.
Tiny
thing.
Yes, it was all tiny.
But then later.
Like anything fusion.
There's the crash, and then they go through the packaged foods and like Pop-Tarts and stuff like that. But I mean, what you're going for is like Victorian Regency restoration. Yeah. Somebody sewing together a goose and a pig to make you like a fake like griffin or whatever. It's thoroughly wonderful. I mean, like there's like a frog's leg dish when they are doing French Imperial that is like truly like Giles eats it and he's like, this is amazing, like this is a wonderful thing, how did they do this? But so frequently they are eating breakfast that they are disgusted by. Oh, and the other great thing about the show is before the first day and then after the last day they go to the doctor. And the doctor tells them how much their body fat has increased or decreased.
Oh, wow.
And whether they're healthier. And it was like far and away the healthiest thing they did was live like they were Britain during the Blitz. Like when they were just
rationed World War II.
Yes. Like, when they were just eating root vegetables. But there were a couple of times that a couple of those like super like meat and fat heavy like cuisines like really ended up making them like lose some weight or something like that, but most of the time it made their
but are they living
explode.
Are they living as they are
like
they're
they
in that time
outfits. That's what I'm confused about.
No, they put on outfits and they do activities and they like do little
sketches or something like that.
Not really sketches, but they do like confessionals at night sort of explaining how they feel about things. And there's a very sketchy element to like when Sue decides that she's going to dance off some of this food by learning French court dances or whatever. It's pretty goofy, but a lot of fun.
What a great concept.
Yes. There was, for the 70s one, they were drinking 70s cocktails, and they truly were some of the grossest things I've ever seen. You guys are listening to Pop Rocket. It's a podcast. I don't know if anyone told you that. But we're going to be right back to talk about problematic faves right after this.
Hey guys, this is Adam Conover. You may know me from my True TV show, Adam Ruins Everything. Well, guess what? Now we're doing a podcast version right here on Maximum Fun. What we do is we take all the interesting, fascinating experts that we talk to for just a couple minutes on the show, and we sit with them for an entire podcast, really going deep and getting into the fascinating details of their work. Find Adam Ruins Everything wherever you get your podcasts or at MaximumFun.org.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
And Karen Thompson.
And today we're going to be talking about our problematic faves. Last week I saw a stream of a panel at South by Southwest that was moderated by Aisha Harris from Slate. And Jenny Yang was on it, and Jeff Yang was on it, and other people whose names I forget. But they were talking about like pieces of pop culture that they loved in past that on reevaluation are really problematic. And so I, as a white man, wanted to steal that idea from people of color and use it for my own benefit. But much love and respect to everyone who was on that panel. It was so great. And I thought that we could go and talk about stuff that we love, but is from a different time and has got real political problems, or just got real problems to it. Who wants to jump in?
Well, can I first ask what, you know, what truly constitutes a problematic fave? Because when I reflect on my pop cultural taste in general, everything I like is essentially problematic.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, whether or not it's my, like, love of rom-coms, my, you know, penchant for things like Grey's Anatomy on television, but basically, because all of pop culture is geared towards a particular mainstream and representing only certain groups of people for the most part. So, you know, there are many ways that I could say, or my love of British costume dramas, that could all be seen as problematic because of who I am, because of the positionality that I take as a queer person of color, as a woman. And so, I mean, you know, are all of my faves problematic, and are, for some people, are their faves unproblematic because they're part of the mainstream culture?
Well, then the other question, too, is, like, what makes something problematic exactly?
Mm-hmm.
Like, can there be a movie about a character who inhabits some problematic ideas or characteristics? They're racist, or they're misogynist, or somehow... like flawed, but the movie itself is not necessarily taking on those traits, if that makes any sense, you know?
Well, and the other side of that is, what about The Philadelphia Story? It's a nice breezy rom-com that takes place, you know, in a world where segregation still exists in most of America. I mean, I think for all of this stuff, like, the world ain't perfect.
Right. And it never was and never will be.
And art is reflecting that in so many ways. And for me, it's about the knife's edge of like the Mikado of this thing where I'm like, I love the art that went into this so much, but also it's got so much on top of everything about Asian people. You probably don't know this because they change it in most scripts, but it drops the N-word.
The Mikado, yeah.
That's right.
But also, and most of our art is also made by kind of heinous people.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, that's another thing, too. I mean,
yeah.
You know, like...
Yeah. The creator.
I mean, I know Winter still loves Ben Affleck.
Problematic fave. Look, I tried to step off after that 15-year-old groping video came out, because I'd actually never seen that, and then I was just like... I don't know what to do. I'm struggling. And now ever since he and Matt decided they're going to have an inclusion writer, I'm weak for dick. But it doesn't matter.
For you, what's the heart of a problematic fave?
The heart of a problematic fave?
Yeah. Like, what is the essence of it? Like, what should that term mean? What does it mean to you?
It's like something that you can't look away from, like Ben Affleck. But you know that they have serious issues.
Yeah.
There's serious things. And I think the scale is, can you stomach it?
Mm-hmm.
And can you just not tolerate it? I've talked about this many times. I can't watch Raw or Delirious. There are so many parts where I'm just like, ouch. And that was my favorite thing growing up. I would quote the shit out of that.
Me too.
And now I'm like so uncomfortable about it. Like, I don't even know what Eddie Murphy in this era does or means.
Well,
I don't.
I think to be a fan or an audience member at this point in time is to have people you used to love, people you looked up to, destroyed for
mm-hmm.
you because they've made mistakes.
Well,
and
I mean, Margaret, you just need to understand one of your jobs as a stand-up comedian today is to open with a 10 to 12 minute long story about how trans people are weird. Like the fact that...
Oh, really?
Is that really the case?
Ricky Gervais.
Ricky Gervais, Chris Rock, and Dave Chappelle. And Dave Chappelle in multiple specials on Netflix all have these gigantic chunks. Ricky Gervais's is 17 minutes long.
Yeah.
Well.
And it's just like, why do you think this is your job?
And it's so... But the thing is, you know what's interesting about that guy? Is like, these are all different types of comedians.
Yes. Yeah.
But yet there's that same just like mean, spiteful, but we're just kidding. We're not challenging anybody. It's fine to do what you want to do.
Because
thing. But it's so like, it's so inappropriate, and the apologists, the POV that they have towards where they're like, we have free speech, we can say what we want, but we love you, we're just making fun of you thing. Like, it's, they're trying to make it okay again, and that to me is worse than MAGA.
The thing is like, Eddie Murphy Delirious does start out with 5 minutes of some of the grossest homophobic material you've ever seen.
He says faggot like 24
times. He just drops it, every breath, practically.
Really, really good special, where those specials from, like, the Ricky Gervais and, like, I love Chris Rock and Dave Chappelle, and those specials are, like, three quarters baked, you know?
Yeah, and not that great.
Well, the thing that's surprising, too, is that you look at somebody like Ricky Gervais, who, like, his humor seems to be based on, like, this heightened self-awareness.
Yeah.
And then you have a bit like that, where it's like, what happened?
I'll tell you.
And it's still based, on this idea that that a root of comedy is to make fun of other people.
Yeah.
Like, actively making fun of people, as opposed to some kind of trend or idea or, like...
Let's splash into one of my problematic faves, and that is... Fashion police. For me, like, my mom talking shit at fabulous people on the TV is like a source of where comedy comes from for me. Like, it really is one of the things that feels best. And I've always loved that show. And I feel like so much of its DNA is shared with things like roast shows or roast battle that are traditionally male sort of like combative comedy spaces. And I understand all of that, but I also understand that it is a show that is essentially just about picking apart women's appearances. Like, it is a show that is unconcerned with men. I used to write for that show. I love it. I also know that, like, some of the times we were writing these jokes and we were like, why the fuck are we doing this? And it's hard because on the one hand, I love it, and I don't know if that I need to release that love.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, it's very difficult to discern where the line is between, like, a kind of loving ribbing, the kind that you share within your family or in these intimate spaces or whatever, like, with intimates in a certain way, and when you're just, for cheap laughs, going after people who everyone else agrees is still too different.
Yeah.
And I think that that's where historically it shifts over the course of time because, you know, maybe in the 80s it was okay to be yelling like faggot every other word. And, you know, and now I think that it's sort of like edgy and on the line to be making jokes about trans people and about like your maybe lack of capacity to deal with that or just like and sharing that, like that being your kind of connect with people. But that's, you know, but that I think fundamentally is the wrong place to try to make a connection is around a kind of a negative and prejudiced association with anybody. Yeah. And I think that that's where, you know, that's where it like feels uncomfortable and it feels problematic. But like kind of what you were saying, like if there's something else in the rest of it that redeems it in the production of it or in the content of it that gives it a different kind of arc or entry point, you know, the great cultural studies scholar Stuart Hall was always like, you know, all of popular culture is problematic essentially, but like, you know, it's about our different entry points to it. And about like, you know, we can have an entry point that connects and we can have an entry point that like sees it critically, but we can still derive pleasure from that, you know?
Well, so much art, including comedy, is based on like the forbidden, right?
Yeah.
Like the things we think, but we're not supposed to say.
Yeah.
And then the idea, I think, with those comedians, like, you know, kind of taking the crowd aside and being like, you know what? I still think trans people are weird.
Yeah.
You know, there's supposed to be this idea that we're all like divulging information and that you get closer to the audience kind of telling them something that, like, is unsightly about yourself, but, like, they feel it too, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the fashion police also traffics in that, because, like, who among us can look at a person and not make a snap judgment?
Right.
Based on their clothes, based on their appearance.
Or look at ourselves in that way, too.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And so I think there is this, like, age-old tradition, and certainly women are always the locus of that tradition of, like, you know, take a woman's appearance and that's all you can say about her. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's nothing else in the end but what she looks like, how she presents. Doesn't matter if she's smart. Doesn't matter if she's won a million awards. It's like, does she look good in that dress?
And it's so hard. And it is something that, like, so privileges, like, it's something that so privileges young women and thin women and white women and all of those things. But it's also just, like, the one home of hard jokes by women and gay guys for women and gay guys.
Yeah.
And it has a place in my heart that...
Well, there's a clubhouse culture to it, right?
Yes.
Like you just said, like, there's not a lot of straight men watching that necessarily.
Well, and also, what's funny is when I was watching it as an 8-year-old, or just watching Joan Rivers as an 8-year-old, it felt like the core of punching up to me, even though I didn't understand that idea of punching up. But it was like this person who feels excluded fighting back at the people who are included. And then as time has gone on, like, I've gotten a far more nuanced, like, perspective on that. And, you know, not everybody who's showing up to the Golden Globes needs to have shit talked about.
So true.
Anybody else got a problematic fave that they would like to submit to the room?
Saturday Night Live.
Okay, let's talk about it.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I've been watching it since I was a kid, and I've talked about the show ad nauseum on this show, but I'm starting to learn that as I get older, this show has reached, like, a point where it's no longer impactful. So it feels much more like a chore to watch it than it, like, I look forward to watching it. And I spent, like, my entire life letting go of some of the more problematic elements of it, and now I can't unsee the glaring issues with that show. I can't unsee the fact that when I saw Terry Sweeney on Assassination of Gianni Versace a couple weeks ago, I hadn't thought about Terry Sweeney in so long.
Terry Sweeney is the only out gay man who's ever been on SNL. It was the 1985 season, I believe, back when Lorne didn't run things.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Gene was running things.
Yeah.
And I think about I know Eddie Murphy himself is problematic, but the fact that he really doesn't like the association with that show, even though that show made him, I can only imagine what he dealt with there while he was on that show. Chris Rock only hints at it, but everybody's so damn afraid.
He barely had a role on that
show. He barely had a role on it. And then I look at the way that women are positioned. Like, I have a problem with that. And that's why I think that, you know, who is writing, who's out there and pushed up to the front, who gets the plum opportunities to put on dumb ass, terrible, horrible sketches and writing.
To me, it seems a little bit like the Tom Colicchio problem that we were talking about before, of, like, looking at some people and being like, yeah, that kid, he's it.
Yeah.
A little bit feeling like you see themselves in them.
Yes.
And I've had people on the inside say, like, Catholic boys from the Midwest always do the best there.
Yes,
it's so true.
Yeah. And it's hard to watch. There has been a conversation on Twitter over the past couple of days because
you've been part of it.
I have been part of it. James Adomian was talking about
amazing article.
Yeah.
About the fact he did an interview where he talked about the fact that there hasn't been an out gay man since Terry Sweeney on the show, and then Alec Baldwin came hard at James Adomian. And it was just one of those, like,
I didn't see that part.
Alec Baldwin, you're trying to be a nice liberal. Like, why do you have to spend so much time and energy defending your clubhouse?
Yeah. But if you think about the origins of the show, and I've read everything, I've read every book, I've read every single thing. I'm talking about, I've been a fan literally since birth. This show was built on sort of like that underlying discriminatory, like, just like that weird, whatever Lorne possesses in his version of what, like, comedy is. Like, comedy, when a black guy does it, is like step and fetch it. But when, like, a drunk heroin addict does it, it's like give him a five
picture.
It's raw. And it's like, everybody, everybody's so surprised hearing these Chevy Chase stories lately. And, like, no, everyone is like, no, he's been like this the entire fucking time.
I do love that, a white guy with a severe drug and alcohol problem is always a more redeeming investment than any black woman.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, Janine Garofalo had a lot to say about being on the show. But also, I'm just thinking about the current cast and, like, you know, we get a solid 60 minutes, basically, of Beck Bennett every week.
We do, girl. Damn.
And, yeah, and when you've got, like, when you've got him, like,
he did an entire sketch this weekend where I was like, who fucking approved this?
He's there all the time, and yet you get barely get any Leslie Jones.
Barely a snippet of that. Unless she's yelling about something that shocked her.
Yeah, and then maybe a little Kate McKinnon. I mean, you know, I mean, no Melissa Villaseñor.
Never.
The thing about Leslie Jones is she as a stand-up comic, is able to make her own material and make her own perspective. And Melissa Villaseñor is a very funny stand-up comic, but she is this fucking impression machine.
Yeah.
And they cannot figure out what to do with her.
Well, why could they figure out Bill Hader and not her?
Or Beck Bennett and not her? Because, you know, it's just like he comes in and does a kind of half-assed Putin, and you're just like, you know, or he's just like the perfect kind of generic white guy who kind of fits into all these, or like your Jason Sudeikis types from, like,
love Jason Sudeikis, though.
He's a really funny guy, but I mean, I'm just like, that is who thrives and who's been thriving in the last, like, maybe like half a decade on SNL at this point.
One thing that's interesting is the person I know best who is on SNL was Brooks Wheelan, who was another white guy and one who didn't make it. And they can come back at us with, like, oh, well, there are lots of white guys who fail too, but there are so many more white guys going through the machine.
And getting, like, a couple years off of it.
Yeah.
I used to turn on SNL, and it would hit every note. It hit every mark. Every time I turn it on, and Alec Baldwin is Trump now at this point, I don't want it. It's not funny. We're in a different era. We're in a different world.
Well, it's hard to watch something and be
hard,
like,
to white, yes.
It's hard to watch something like that and be like, this is for those white boys to have their fun. And the best kind of fun we can have is to watch that and never imagine that, like, our fun could be part of that.
Right.
Margaret, drop a problematic fave on us.
Gone with the Wind.
And it's gone through so many phases of, like, being problematic, too.
It's gone through so many phases. I mean, I first saw this movie when I was maybe 8 or 9 years old, and it came on TV, and I was living in the South.
And an enthusiastic segregationist.
Well, I was living in the South, and my parents were, like, kind of horrified by the situations that I saw as a young child. Like, in my own school, there was just, like, not... like, almost like de facto segregation, basically. And my parents were taking great pains to explain to me, like, this is not okay. And, you know, my dad was from Chicago, and this was all an alien landscape to him, and he thought it was really repugnant. And when Gone with the Wind came on, my mom was like, you should just sit and watch this. I think you'll like it. And I did gravitate towards it right away because I was 8 or 9 and the petticoats alone were like, oh my God, you know, it's just like
the color, the technicolor.
Yeah,
the technicolor, and Tara the Plantation looked gorgeous, and it was just like this really opulent dream. And it is this incredibly soapy melodrama that heaps on. I mean, there's not a dull moment in that movie. Mm-hmm. It's completely, every second there's something huge going on, some giant shift. And what's interesting about Scarlett O'Hara in this time is that, to me, rewatching this recently felt really instructional about women, white women in particular, who voted for Trump. Uh-huh. Like, I'm still, you know, 2 years later or whatever it is, like, trying to work out these women in my mind, where I'm like, what was it that you, what kind of, like, island in the sun, like, were you voting for? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, what is the fantasy in your mind of, like, what Trump means? And of course, it's all about these women, like, protecting themselves within the world of patriarchy, right?
Yes.
Like, what do we have to do to survive
and
within...
Keep it cute and keep that Costco in that Ram, Dodge, Ram filled up and everybody happy.
The answer is to have the strongest, richest man holding you.
Yes, exactly. So you can get all those Capri Suns for your babies and whatever.
I want a 48 count.
So, I mean, Scarlett is so fucking complicated. complicated because on some levels, like, she is the first anti-heroine in movies. Like, this is a woman who is not very likable, but at the same time, like, got her own. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. managed to survive and thrive. And, like, Margaret Mitchell, the woman who wrote Gone with the Wind, famously said, like, if there's one book one word I could boil this whole story down to, it'd be survival.
Yeah.
And that is true with Scarlett, is that she just basically looks at her world and she says, how am I going to survive and how am I going to thrive? And so she constantly is looking at men in particular and how she can manipulate them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's all about, like, when I think of the term feminine wiles, I feel like that must have been, like, invented with Scarlett.
Well, you also know that, like, it had a gay director for most of the time that mm-hmm. they were doing it, and then it was only at the end that the guy who's credited... what?
Weiler? No.
No, it was George Cukor for, like,
that's what I was gonna say.
For most of it, and then yeah. some dude who was hunting buddies with Rhett.
David O. Selznick or something?
Yeah, took over. But it is something that is, like, suffused with more legitimate feminine perspective than epics of that nature usually are.
But then it's also interesting that, like, a narrative of survival, or one that we get, is just, like, of someone who is an incredibly privileged, as you were saying, an incredibly privileged white woman, and we get to see the struggle of survival and maybe perhaps empathize with it through that lens, versus what about all the other people trying to survive in this, like,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
post-bellum
well, I mean,
situation?
You see the other slaves basically manipulating her to survive, you know? And, like, there's been all this, like, you know, Mammy, that character Mammy, played by Hattie McDaniels, who won the Oscar for her portrayal, the first African-American woman to win an award.
What a problematic, like, this,
such
this
a complicated
moment of, like,
character.
We are rewarding a black professional for the first time ever in this way, but also for being
a slave.
What white people, and also what white people want out of a slave.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, like, Prissy at least sasses back and has demands and needs of her own. Mammy is always there for you, telling you that you should eat pancakes before the barbecue.
Right, although you have to, God. I mean, there's something worth pointing out, is that Mammy is the only other character besides Rhett Butler who has Scarlett's number.
Yeah.
She calls out Scarlett all the time. She's the only one, really. Even Rhett is sort of like, I don't know what you're always up to. But, like, everything that Scarlett says, like, Mammy's sitting there being like, oh my God, she's going to do what? Like, yeah. She sees it 10 steps ahead.
Well, what's so interesting is that we only confront black stories from before 1975, essentially, to reach around and pat white people on the back. At this point, like, for the past 50 years of making stories about black people, the story has always been, and then there were some good white people and they were okay.
Yeah.
And there is a way that the stuff that comes from the times when everybody was still just comfortable being horrible kind of lets black people be human in different ways, you know?
What do you mean exactly?
I mean, in that thing of, like Mammy having Scarlett's number and understanding that she is a person who needs to be operated as opposed to, you know.
Well, and Prissy, like you were saying, like, she's subversive. Like, in a way, like, her sort of, like, back-talking and, like, you know, you see that this moment in the movie where she claims that she knows how to deliver a child and then she actually doesn't.
Yeah.
And, like, that has been interpreted as this also kind of rebellion, you know, that, like, you just tell them what they want to hear, the white folk. But,
exactly.
Like, in reality, like, you're going to protect your own. And I think there's something to be said about, you know, all of these people, you take what they're doing and you apply it to the system that they live in. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, in some ways, like, Scarlett, there's, like, you can never call her a feminist hero because she owns slaves.
Yeah.
And she will do any ruthless, capitalist, disgusting thing to get ahead. But at the same time, like, she was operating within the system. So it's like all these people within these systems that, like, you can have some degree of empathy for because, like, what else were they going to do?
Mm-hmm. Karen, you got a problematic fave for us?
As I said, my entire taste in popular culture is a treasure trove of problematic favorites. But I will say that you are sunlight and I moon. That is a lyric from the musical Miss Saigon. And it was a huge success when it came out. I believe it was like first came out in 1989. It won some Tonys in 1991. And there are many reasons that Miss Saigon as a musical is problematic. First of all, it's a show, a musical about the Vietnam War written by two French guys, Alain Boubile and Claude-Michel Schoenberg. And so they're romanticizing, essentially, you know, the kind of story of Vietnam and French colonial relationship to it. It's also an adaptation of Madame Butterfly. So there's a lot of problems with that already.
Yeah.
And you have all of your typical Orientalist tropes going into that show, including the sun and moon bit that I just quoted for you. But, you know, one of the reasons that it was one of my favorites, well, I'll give you two huge reasons. Number one, as an Asian person, as an Asian American, it's very hard to see yourself in any form of popular culture, particularly in the era in which I was growing up. It's become a little better in the recent decade. I won't say decades, but, you know, there have been more opportunities to see that in U.S. popular culture. But also because Miss Saigon became, and I've talked a little bit about this on the show before, a real entry point for Filipino performers and entertainers to become seen in the U.S. context. Lea Salonga, who played the lead Kim, the Vietnamese girl, in the show, who is essentially the Madame Butterfly figure, who meets a white officer, falls in love at the cusp of the fall of Saigon, and then, you know, ends up having his child after she's been abandoned there because he's fled because, you know, Americans had to, like, be expunged from the nation. Anyway, Lea Salonga won a Tony Award for Best Actress in a Musical, and that was a huge deal. So, I mean, so in many respects, I saw myself as like, oh, I could potentially someday, even though I have no hope to ever be in theater as a young person singing musical theater in my high school, like, what role am I going to get? Connie Wong, Never White in A Chorus Line.
Yeah.
Am I going to try to find like some revival of Flower Drum Song? Do I try to work my way into South Pacific as a Bloody Mary or something like that? You know, and then you get like this meaty role that Lea Salonga plays, and that's Kim. And there are whole cottage industries actually. Like the Miss Saigon employed generations and continues to employ generations of Filipina actors and actresses, and which is also super problematic because barely any Vietnamese people ever get cast to be in a show about Vietnam. So that's also the other thing too, where there's many layers of shame there attached to it. You know, because there are actually whole schools that have arisen in different parts of the Philippines to train people to be in Miss Saigon.
Really?
Yeah, they're Miss Saigon schools. My dear friend Lucy May San Pablo Burns wrote about this in her book Pura Arte. But like their whole, yeah, it's a whole industry. Another Filipino export industry is just being in the cast of Miss Saigon. And you know, which it says a lot. And in the one of the things that I shared with you all is like the Making of Miss Saigon documentary. And in those early audition rounds, for any of you who've seen it or who will look at it, it's just, you see them auditioning all these folks. And there are Vietnamese women who come and audition. And one of the most patronizing things that comes up in that audition process is that the composers say, you know, about this Vietnamese woman, well, she's almost too pretty or too, she looks too much like a model to be in the show. Meaning, but part of it is she looked too sexually mature.
Yeah.
So they're like, as if to say a Vietnamese woman looks too sexualized already, and therefore we will get some more innocent, like really young 16-year-old Filipina chick to play her instead.
Oh, God.
So that's, again, so many layers of problems. But yeah, I open it to conversation.
To the two people of color in the room, like when you were younger, like the difference between these like very marginalized, problematized people who looked like you versus the nice white men who were at the center of the story. Like, were you excited to see those moments of identification, or did it very frequently feel like, why does she have to be doing that? Or she only gets to say one line or whatever?
How did you feel? I mean, like for example, like on TV, like when you get like representations of, I don't know, like how'd you feel about Tootie?
I mean, You know, the problem that sucks for me is that I'm very proud to be Black. So every time I see a person reflected on screen like me, I'm more apt to, like, respond to the person who is kind of just like me, which is just, like, a little bit of militance and a little bit of, like, sassy, and then a little bit of, like, I'm a little bit better than you, like a snobby version of me. I never really saw that person except in, like, little spurts, like the Black cheerleader in the theatrical version of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Or, like, what's in the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air? What was her name?
Oh, Hillary.
Or Hillary. But then I was darker skinned, so I didn't really relate to her. So it was more like of a Jada thing. I always responded to women like that. Tootie, I definitely responded to. But I never really saw them outside of it, probably just because of who I'm marrying. But I always saw it as men brought them into their space because they added something that these other girls could not fulfill. Mm-hmm. So I think that might have been like a more of an egomaniacal thing on my part. But I actually think, looking back now, that really actually might be true.
Or occasion or opportunity to be represented, right? Like, I mean, I think especially...
I just don't think we were there for just always just to be.
Well, I just like witnessed my mom being just so thrilled every time she saw any Asian person, no matter what they were doing on screen. And these are stories that people have about, I mean, you know, when you hear Whoopi Goldberg talking about seeing Uhura on Star Trek for the first time, she's like, it's the first time I saw a Black woman on the TV who wasn't a maid, right?
But she didn't, but that was a different era. By the time I was born, Black, like, little Black kids were being taken in by white parents.
So
they were essentially the star of the show, and to us, they were positioned as stars. So Webster had, like, Webster dolls and cartoons and movies. So, like, I didn't see the difference between that, and it didn't become problematic until I got older and Different Strokes was problematic.
You know, when people talk about representation, it doesn't accomplish too much. Well, what it does is it influences how we move through the world and how we can see ourselves moving through the world. And so, but I do still, I know every song from Miss Saigon by heart, and I will sing any Miss Saigon duet with anybody who asks me to at karaoke.
Please be advised, Rocketeers. You are listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, Rocketeers, it's Laura Swisher, senior producer at Maximum Fun and fellow Pop Rocket aficionada. If you have a second, open up your calendars and put a big red circle around April 2nd. That's when we're launching our annual Max Fun Drive. 2 weeks of great programming across the network. It's also the best time to support Pop Rocket because we'll be offering great gifts for new and upgrading members. And if you can't wait till then to show your support, you can tweet nice things about the Pop Rocket panelists right now. But also remember to show your support during the Max Fun Drive. April 2nd. Did I mention it was April 2nd?
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Brandon. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
And Karen Thompson.
And every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what's your current jam? So I'm going to ask... Karen Thompson, what is your current jam?
Speaking of problematic faves, I didn't even get to talk about my problematic relationship to all forms of white femininity.
That's a whole hour.
That's a whole hour, and maybe several others that cost over $200 an hour in terms of therapy. But my jam is from another Swedish electronic pop artist. Her name is Tova Styrka. She finished third on the Swedish Idol a few years back. She's been kind of making it on the pop rounds. She opened for Lorde on her most recent tour, and she's also scheduled to tour with Katy Perry. Her latest is this new ditty called I Changed My Mind.
I'm not the one to tell you that you're not the one. Just throw it out and take it back. Could be the drinks or history, but either way you get to me, I'll give you that. Got me up and down, but I light up without you. I said I wouldn't try another time, but I'm down right now.
I just love shit like that. I mean, I know it's super bubblegum and it's just like all the catchy little sounds, but that's my jam.
We all know that I like all the catchy little sounds.
Yeah, you do.
Magwap.
Magwap. Hashtag Magwap.
Magwap, what's your jam?
You know, when you have a baby, you just find yourself all of a sudden putting on these songs that come from your Midwestern childhood, speaking of problematic, and you don't think about it, and you don't think about the lyrics that are stupid, like about squeezing lemons down your leg or anything like that. You just go for like what has this visceral, nostalgic punch to the gut. So my jam is Led Zeppelin's Good Times, Bad Times. Basically, babies like to rock out.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
I love how much music like that was just listened to by everyone so much growing up that it. I do enjoy it. Like, yeah. Hey, it's just...
It gets you, right?
Yeah, that's what the boys were listening to.
And I have to say, Robert Plant, he has revamped himself. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's doing better these days.
Yeah.
Not so stupid.
Not so dumb.
Winter Mitchell.
I don't have one. But... I guess maybe I can throw it to the Rocketeers because I'm putting together a playlist for our DJ for the wedding. And I'm going to put it on the group on Wednesday. I want people to create a wedding list.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Based on like five different artists I name. Just come up with some shit.
You know what David and I did in our wedding that was really great mm-hmm. is that we assigned each of our friends, the friends who have good musical taste, mm-hmm. we assigned each friend a like half an hour DJ booth time.
Oh,
and that's crazy, and that's not going to happen.
It was amazing. I'm telling you.
No, that works for you. I'm a Kanye-zilla, so that won't at all happen. I paid $5,000 for a guy that usually DJs like... enterprise shareholder conferences, and he's amazing. And I want a specific thing, but I do want people's input and feedback because we have to submit to him ideas. And if I give you guys like three or four regulations on how it's going to come together and you come back to me, maybe we'll implement it. I don't know. We'll see.
I was going to have no jam, but Laura, I will ask you to drop in a chunk of Three Little Maids from School from Topsy Turvy, just because I love that Mike Lee made an entire movie.
With the Mikado in there.
Well, but just so that you could have the Mikado contextualized.
Yes.
So that you could like put it in a world where there were actual Asian people or actual Japanese people who were there and understand it in its racist colonial tones.
Three little maids from school are we, hot as a schoolgirl well can be, filled to the brim with girlish glee. Three little maids from school,
thanks.
Everything is a source of fun. Nobody safe for we care for none. Life is a joke that's just begun.
All right, you've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Brandon, with Winda Mitchell, Margaret Wappler, and Karen Thompson. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to everyone for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. We don't have any names here. I assume that no one has given us a 5-star review
on
iTunes.
Are you not entertained?
I'm going to say that...
that's problematic.
I mean, yeah. Is it affecting Margaret's blood iron levels? I don't know.
Am
but
I problematic?
Yes. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We are at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and get in the discussion. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producer is my old friend Laura Swisher.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.